keynote session, which I'm really excited about. You can see the topic there, general relativity and gravitational waves. So the presenter is Dr. Stephen Green. He's a postdoc at Primrose Institute. He's Canadian from Etobicoke, part of, yes, just here, right here in Ontario, just not too far from in Toronto, so west of Toronto, and he works in strong gravity and general relativity, went to grad school at the University of Chicago. There's a very, very, very famous, very widely used book on textbook on general relativity by Robert Wall. And who was actually very famous in one of general relativity, was actually Stephen's advisor during grad school. And now working on a host of sort of fun topics. And we have for the next sort of hour and 20 minutes or so. So just give him a warm welcome to our special.
All right, yeah. Now, thanks for the introduction, Damien, and for inviting me to speak here. Yeah, so I'm just going to give an overview of general relativity and gravitational waves. So, you know, just feel free to ask as many questions as you want throughout the talk. I have about 30 slides, which is probably not that many for an hour and 20 minutes, but we'll see. Okay, so the overall outline of this talk is, first I'm going to start with basics and with Newtonian gravity. And after explaining that, I will explain general relativity at a simple level and basically try to contrast it with Newtonian gravity and see what these differences are. And then I'll talk about some solutions of general relativity, like black holes and gravitational waves. And then I'll talk about the recent detection of gravitational waves. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about my own research into black hole instabilities. Okay, so in Newtonian gravity. I know this. You've probably all seen this a million times, but if you have two bodies, then they attract each other with this force, the Newton's constant times the masses of the two objects divided by r squared, and this force is along the direction between them. But it's more useful to think in terms of this Newtonian gravitational potential, where, so we could say the potential exerted by object one is the Newton's constant times the mass of object one divided by r. I'm just drawing that here. This is this potential exerted by object one. And then the force on object two is minus its mass times the gradient. So it has this force pushing it down, this potential here. This is a more convenient formulation because then we can write down that, you know, this potential obeys this Poisson equation, which is yeah, this is the Poisson equation, and this is kind of the general solution to find the potential. So what does this equation contain? Well, we have the Newtonian potential, this phi here, and this upside down, this triangle thing is nabla squared. That's the Laplacian differential operator. So it means to take this second partial derivatives along x, y, and z of phi. So you're saying this differential operator acting on phi is equal to the Newton's constant times whatever mass density you have. So this equation is really easy to solve. So once you know this matter distribution, you can find the Newtonian potential. And it's a linear equation, so you can add up solutions and get, you know, new solutions to the equation. But there's a problem with this equation, which is that, well, once 1905 came along and Einstein discovered special relativity, this was no longer consistent with this picture. So in Newtonian gravity, you're solving this Poisson equation on one time slice, so x, y, and z, and, well, there's no preferred choice of spatial slice in special relativity, so that doesn't really make any sense. And also, you have instantaneous propagations of signals in Newtonian gravity. If I move some objects, then I'm instantaneously going to feel it far away, but that's inconsistent with special relativity as well. So, well, electromagnetism was already consistent with special relativity, and that was some of Einstein's motivation to develop special relativity, but maybe we could fix Newtonian gravity somehow. So a naive kind of first try would be if we replace this left-hand side, this Laplacian of phi, with a wave operator. So we just basically add this minus second time derivative of phi. So now we have a, so solutions to this equation are like, are waves. And yeah, and now, so the left-hand side is now Lorentz invariant and consistent with special relativity. But unfortunately, this equation is inconsistent with observations. And there are also some theoretical reasons why it doesn't work. So for example, you have this there's this desire to have everything gravitate. And so for example, if you have some electromagnetic fields, those are going to exert a gravitational field. But this equation won't do that because it's a linear equation. We need it to be a nonlinear equation. So that's a theoretical reason why this is not a good equation to choose. Well, and finally, 10 years after special relativity, Einstein wrote down the equations of general relativity. So this is fundamentally different now. So in general relativity, you replace this Newtonian potential, this phi, with the space-time geometry. So I'll explain a bit more what I mean by that later. But so we're replacing this equation with this new one that's called the Einstein equation. And so what this equation means, on the left-hand side here, this GAB, this is known as the Einstein tensor. And it describes the curvature of the space-time geometry. And then the right-hand side, this TAB, this is not just the the mass density of your matter, but it contains also its momenta and stresses. So it's a lot more information about that. So this is called the stress-energy-momentum tensor for the matter. So this is very different now. They're both, of course, second-order partial differential equations, but now we're describing this space-time geometry instead of phi. So this is this new idea that gravity is space-time geometry. So this is completely different because before we were thinking about fields, this phi, living in a flat space-time, and now we're thinking about space-time itself being curved. So this is my representation in two dimensions of what's happening. So, and this is a common sort of trick that physicists use to visualize things is we obviously can't visualize a four-dimensional curved surface. That's really tough to do. So what we do is we just drop some dimensions and we think about two dimensions, and you can easily visualize a two-dimensional curved surface like this. And then, so Einstein's equation tells you space-time curvature, the left-hand side, and then a solution to that equation is what we call a space-time metric, or the geometry. So this idea is, well, but then the question is, how can space-time geometry be the same as gravity? That they seem like totally different things. And the answer is that then objects in space-time follow geodesics, which are, you can think of them as, you know, as close a trajectory as possible to a straight trajectory. But the issue is that your space-time is curved now. So if you have a flat space and you start off with two parallel lines, they're going to remain parallel. But if I have a curved space, like this sphere, and I start off with two parallel trajectories, just because of the curvature of the sphere, they're going to intersect at the North Pole. And it's the same with gravity. So if I'm in a plane and I fall out, I'm going to hit the Earth because both the Earth and me, we're going to follow as straight a possible trajectory through this curved spacetime, and they happen to intersect. So this is idea here about how curved spacetime is the same as gravity. And this was this radical idea of Einstein's. Okay. Well, now going back, let's look at the Einstein equation a little bit more closely now. First, it's much more difficult to solve than the Poisson equation. So this is maybe the most technical slides I have, but they're just trying to get across the ideas of why this is complicated to solve. Well, first, notice that there's these AB indices on this equation, and these indices run over the dimensions 0, 1, 2, and 3. There's four dimensions for space and time. And so you have essentially 16 equations here, you know, 4 squared, However, these quantities are symmetric in their indices under interchange. So in fact, there are just 10 components of these equations. But this is compares to one in the Newtonian case. So there's a lot more components to your equation that you have to solve. Another issue that makes it a lot more complicated is that it's a nonlinear equation. So you can't, I said before, with Newtonian gravity and the Poisson equation, you can add solutions together to get a new solution. But you can't do that anymore in Einsteinian gravity. So you no longer have superposition. And physically, this means that the gravitational field, it carries energy itself. And and any type of energy can gravitate. So this gravity gravitates. So you have this extreme example. You have black holes that are just space-time curvature. And they exert a big gravitational field. OK. This is a more technical issue here, is that not all 10 of these equations are independent. You have these relationships between them. So in fact, there's only 6 independent equations. And this corresponds to this freedom. When you specify a geometry, you have to specify coordinates as well. And that just makes it all more complicated, that we have to think about various coordinate systems. And then finally, the other major difference, I would say, is that the Poisson equation is what's called elliptic. So you have solutions like for, you know, it's always solved on one, at one moment in time, and you get your solution. You might be your 1 over r potential. But the Einstein equation has elliptic characteristics, but it's also hyperbolic. And this means that we have propagating wave solutions to the Einstein equation, which we don't have to the Newtonian equation. And this is very similar to Maxwell's equations of electromagnetism, because, you know, of course, we have electrostatics, which you describe the field of stationary charges, but we also have wave solutions, because electromagnetism also describes light propagation. So in fact, you can, if you want to go back to the counting, we have 6 independent equations, and really, 2 of these equations are, you can think of them as hyperbolic. So we have 2 polarizations of gravitational waves, just like how we have 2 polarizations of light waves. OK, so this is why it's a lot more difficult to solve Einstein's equation. But it also means that the solutions to the Einstein equation are much more interesting than solutions to Poisson's equation. So in fact, there are even interesting solutions to the vacuum equation when you don't have any matter, when we set the right-hand side to 0. And the reason is, well, this represents the space-time curvature, but in fact, it's really only some components of the curvature. And there are a whole bunch of components of the curvature called the Weil curvature, which are unspecified by this. So this is this freedom to find additional solutions. So there's a lot of solutions to the vacuum equation, and now I'm going to look at a couple of them. So the first interesting one is a black hole. So this is a vacuum solution. And I'm going to show you a space-time diagram of a black hole, which is a very useful representation that physicists use to visualize the space-time structure. So in this diagram, the horizontal axis is going to be space, and the vertical axis will be time. So if we had one space dimension and one time dimension, we're going to have 45-degree angles will be something that's moving at the speed of light. So where, you know, for any increment in x, you move the same amount in time. That's the speed of light. And something that moves more in time than it does in x, so something moving more vertically, that's something that's moving at a slower speed than the speed of light. Something that's moving like this is moving faster than light. So any sort of physical object is going to have to remain within this light cone here. I don't know if you guys took a course on special relativity, but this is OK. Yeah, and also, we simplify things. We think about 2 dimensions. We're going to draw a 2-dimensional diagram because our paper is 2-dimensional. So we can drop some dimensions. And so this black hole here, for example, is spherically symmetric. So each point on this diagram represents a sphere. So it's like the Earth. Imagine having an Earth. We have the radial direction that's plotted along this way, and we have the time direction. But we don't care about what happens at different points on the Earth because it's all the same. So this is a black hole. This is the Schwarzschild black hole. And there are several regions in this diagram. So this area bounded over here, this is where we live in here. This is the exterior of the black hole. And then this area is the interior of the black hole. Okay? Now, this dividing line between the interior of the black hole and the exterior, this is called the event horizon. And the point is that if you get, this is basically the definition of the black hole. If you start inside, like over here, you can never get out because you would have to be moving outside of your light cone. Remember, this 45 degree is the speed of light. So once you get in here, you're trapped. And in fact, the only place you can go is to the singularity where you have infinite curvature. So really, once you get into the black hole, the future direction is into the singularity, and there's nothing you can do about that. So again, I'm just illustrating that, you know, light rays are going to move on diagonals in this diagram. But if we had, say, the Earth moving, you know, this is going to move in a time-like direction. It doesn't move faster than the speed of light. So if it falls in past the horizon, there's nothing it can do but hit the black hole because it has to stay within these light cones. So this is, I think, a useful way to visualize what's happening here. Rather than say, well, it's just the gravity is so strong outside a black hole that we can't escape. It's just really the space-time causal structure is such that we can't escape the black hole. Now, you may be wondering about this region over here and this region over here, which I haven't talked about at all. So this is what's called like the maximally extended Schwarzschild space-time. And this is the full solution in spherical symmetry. You actually have, this is called a white hole, and this is called the other universe. So you may have seen this image here for illustrating a black hole. And what this is a drawing of this spatial slice here through our diagram, and we've restored one of the spherical, one of the additional dimensions. So out here, this circle, is way out here, out near far away from the black hole. And then as you approach the horizon, you approach what's called the throat here. And it has a minimum radius, and the radius is 2 times the Schwarzschild mass. That's the event horizon radius. But then it extends out again, it flares out again, and that's your other universe. Now, this is the maximally extended Schwarzschild space-time. But a physical black hole, we don't expect any of this. We don't expect to have the white hole, and we don't expect to have the other universe, because that would form from gravitational collapse, and it's a different solution. This is more of an idealization. OK, so that's the non-rotating black hole. This is a more complicated black hole, which I'm not going to try to explain what's happening in this diagram, except to say you have multiple additional universes all over the place. And this is a rotating black hole. And this is, you may have seen Interstellar, this is what's being illustrated over here. This is their Gargantua. Okay, so that's what I've talked about, you know, stationary black holes, they're just sitting there. What happens if you perturb a black hole? So you give it, throw a sofa into it or something, then it's going to oscillate like a bell. It just rings down. So I'm plotting that amplitude of the perturbation as a function of time. So it oscillates and it decays exponentially. And if you have any given black hole, we could talk about the Schwarzschild one, or we could talk about the rotating one, or whatever. It has its set, just like a bell does. It has its set of characteristic frequencies. And I'm plotting here the frequencies for a Schwarzschild black hole. So if we imagine we have a perturbation that behaves in time at harmonically, like e to the minus I omega t, then these little dots here are the values of omega that this black hole will oscillate at. Now notice it's in a complex plane. So the vertical axis is the complex part of omega, and the horizontal axis is the real part of omega. So if omega was real, then this would just be oscillating in time. But omega has a complex part. So if I plug in a, it has an imaginary part, sorry. If I plug in an imaginary number to in here, then I have minus I times a negative imaginary number, right? So I have, you know, e to the minus I, if I have omega real plus I omega imaginary times t, that's e to the minus I omega real times t times e to the minus omega I t. So the complex, yeah, thanks. The complex frequency encodes also an exponential decay. So that's all that I'm showing here. Probably don't need the lights anymore, but yeah, so that just indicates this, the decay rate as well as the oscillation frequency. So if we were to go out and we were to observe these oscillations, if we were to go out and observe, do you have a question or?
Yeah. Should it be plus omega I?
That's a plus sign. Yeah, you're right. I got the sign wrong. That's a plus sign, but omega I itself is negative. So as you can see, you have the value of omega I is negative, so you still get a decay. So a better way of writing it would be if I put a minus sign here, and I could put, for example, absolute values on that. Might make it clearer what's happening in this case for negative omega I. So these diagrams are kind of useful because they're going to indicate all of the oscillation frequencies of a black hole. And if we were to observe a black hole ringing, then you could find out, well, what is that black hole by looking at how it's oscillating. Okay. Now I'm going to move on to, there's no any questions at this point?
What is it that's oscillating? Is it the structure, the size?
It's this deformation of the black hole. So, it's the space-time is oscillating, and it's no longer exactly spherical. You can have, you just have deformations of the black hole that are moving with different, there's different modes you could have. Yeah, it's just different wobbles, of like a bell, essentially. Yeah?
You said kind of earlier, you said that gravity gravitates.
Yeah.
I didn't quite understand. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so what I mean is that I'm going to talk about gravitational waves in a second, but if you had, say, a gravitational wave, then as it's moving along, but also you would, it carries energy, and then that energy is going to exert like a Coulomb-type field. So you could measure, you could see that in that other effect also. Does that make sense? And then also black holes, that's a solution to the Einstein equation with no matter at all, but it's exerting a strong gravitational effect. And you need nonlinear equations to get objects like black holes. Otherwise, they would just kind of just disperse. So it's you have this gravitational field that, this deformed geometry is being held together by gravity. Yeah.
I always picture black holes having mass.
They do have a mass. Okay. They don't have any matter, though. So that's exactly the same question. So it's the curvature is what carries that mass. That's the energy is being carried in that curvature, and it's not as easy to quantify it as a matter, but
certainly with the Higgs mechanism.
Yeah,
talking about masses, curvature, and with the Higgs mechanism, where mass is seen as something else.
This isn't exactly related to the Higgs mechanism, but it's mass carried in a field. In that sense.
On what you just said.
Yeah.
If you have a massive star that collapses,
yeah,
into, not just beyond neutron star but into a black hole.
Yeah.
It starts off with mass.
Yeah.
Mass is collapsing.
Yeah.
What happens to it?
So that's a really good question. Eventually all of that mass, all of that actual matter, falls into that singularity, and I can go back maybe to. Oops. Yeah, so that matter falls into this singularity, and then afterwards, like say it's all fallen in by this point in time, that slice, afterwards there's no more matter. That's it. It just the thing is we don't really understand what singularities are. And it's kind of with the curvature here is getting so big that really the theory is breaking down. But it tells you enough that the curvature is getting really big. And the matter is gone into the black hole, and then it's gone, and now it takes the form of space-time curvature. Yeah.
So if I understand, the field have mass.
Yeah.
And the black hole is the concentrated
field.
Plate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So because the field is just not a geometrical abstraction, but it's massive things.
Yes. Yeah. It carries
so
mass. Yeah.
Okay.
It carries mass in the field. But the thing is that it's weird because the same field that you're using to measure this mass is the field that has the mass, in that sense.
Yes.
Yeah, it's different to think about it this way. It's unique in that sense.
On the perturbation picture,
yeah.
We can show that the amplitude is decreasing.
Yeah.
It means that there is a loss of energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where is it going?
Oh, this is studied at the linear level, so it's like only studied at a sort of approximate level. But at the next order, when we would actually take that into account, what's happening is the black hole is going to gain a little bit more mass from this energy, and also some of it is going to, I'm going to talk about gravitational waves, and some of it will go away from the black hole in gravitational waves. So one thing I want to emphasize is that, you know, gravitational systems like this are extremely dissipative because, there's a very large viscosity, if you were to think about it like that, because your perturbation can fall into your black hole or it can fly away as a gravitational wave, and it's hard to keep it going. Other than that, so it's very dissipative, but the energy is conserved in that sense. Okay, well maybe there's no other questions. I'll move on. I like the questions, so please keep asking them. Okay, I'm going to talk about gravitational waves now. These are also vacuum solutions, but they're very different, obviously, than black holes. So these would be produced by violent events such as the merger of the two black holes or neutron stars or just this ringing down of the black hole. And, you know, they propagate very long distances at the speed of light, just like light waves would. But now it's space-time that's just rippling. And there are two polarizations of gravitational waves. So remember light, if we have a light wave moving this way, we can have like a polarization along this direction or a polarization along this direction. Now what's happening is, imagine that there's a wave coming, well, out of the board or into the board, and what's being indicated here are, these are kind of fixed points in space, and really what's changing is the space as this wave passes. So this one you see you get this compression and stretching along the horizontal and vertical axes. This is called the plus polarization, and you also have the cross polarization. But the way that what happens when this wave passes is that space is changing in directions perpendicular to the propagation direction. Okay, so here at this point, I just want to stop and show like a summary comparing Newtonian gravity and general relativity. So in Newtonian gravity, your field is your Newtonian potential, but now your field is your space-time geometry. Your field equation is this Poisson equation. Now it's the Einstein equation. This equation has one component versus 10. You have a linear equation versus a nonlinear equation. And then you have elliptic versus this hyperbolic elliptic mix of equations. And then finally, you have two propagating degrees of freedom in gravity. Okay, so that's, I think, the main summary of the difference between these two theories. Okay, well, there's more complicated solutions to the Einstein equation. All those solutions I talked about so far, you can pretty much do by hand, maybe use computers a little bit to figure them out. But what if you have like two black holes merging and sending off a whole bunch of gravitational waves? That would be way too hard to do on, you know, by hand. So we do numerical simulations. So I have a video of one, which is just on the LIGO website, showing the merger of two black holes. So what's being shown here are they've drawn the black holes in black, and this colorful curved stuff, this is an illustration of the space-time curvature associated to these black holes. This is a very nice illustration, and now you can see this is the waveform. I'll talk more about this later, but the point is they're coming into each other, and they're speeding up as they approach. And the reason why they're coming into each other like this is because they're losing energy to gravitational waves, which allows them to come in and attract like this. Now they've slowed down the simulation, and because it's happening too fast, and so they just eventually they merge. They froze it. And they merge into one black hole, and then very quickly you're going to get a ring down, like I mentioned. So that's how you might perturb a black hole. And then they're zooming out and showing the gravitational waves that are coming out from this process. Yeah.
We saw the space-time that was turning around the black hole.
Yeah.
It wasn't the camera of the simulation that was going. Because it stopped, the turning motion stopped after merging.
Yeah.
So would you say that the solution of the Einstein equation gives a static space-time after the merging?
Well, you can put your camera wherever you want, basically, and they're just, you know, choosing to, I mean, sometimes when you see simulations of black holes, they don't even show them moving because they just fix
the
camera.
Is it the camera that was moving?
Well, the camera was moving. I mean, I don't remember exactly what was seen, but I'll play it again.
It's not symmetrical. There isn't a symmetrical ripple.
Yeah. I mean, so here, yeah, the camera's. They're trying to probably say the camera's fixed here, and we're seeing the black holes move.
So
but,
the space-time is turning around
yeah.
the black hole.
Oh yeah. The space-time is like really, you know, fixed to the black holes, right? I mean,
yeah.
It is the black holes.
Okay.
So these holes up here, these are just for illustrative purposes. Look here, these are the black holes.
Yeah.
Right? And but you could of course move your camera, and if you didn't want to see, you know, this movement
yeah,
like this.
But the space-time was static around each black hole. I don't know if it makes sense, but you showed
I
solution where the space-time was turning around the black hole.
Uh-huh.
It's
well,
a curve.
Yes, the Kerr metric is a stationary metric, but you could, I mean, it's kind of arbitrary to put your camera, right? So it's stationary. I would say it's rotating with the black hole, but it stays the same at each point, essentially. So.
What are these vectors on?
I'm not exactly sure what those vectors are. They're probably the direction of some sort of flow or something. Like
if you put a mass there, it would be the direction.
It might be the direction that a geodesic would go or something, but I'm not sure exactly. Sorry, I don't have a good answer for that.
And at the point at which it goes positive, where the space-time is upwards pointing rather than going down into the well.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly
what does that signify?
You mean here? Like the height?
Well, yeah, but there's a point where the movie freezes.
Yeah.
And there's like a peak, a maximum amplitude.
Oh, so yeah, what are they? I think in this figure, if I remember right, the color here, that denotes how the time dilation effect near the black hole. So like the curvature of the time aspect. And then the height, I think that denotes. I might have them switched, but I think the height denotes the spatial curvature at that time. So the fact that the heights are getting big and the colors are getting very red just means that there's a lot of curvature going on, a lot of curvature at this point.
So the time takes slower where it's red, and
yeah.
it takes faster where it's blue.
Yeah, yeah, I would. Yeah, you get this slowdown near the object. You had your hand up for a while.
Yeah. So for the gravitational waves, you talked a little bit about it yesterday, but it's gravitational waves. Correct me if I'm wrong. Caused by an accelerating mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so, is the direction of propagation of the gravitational waves anti-parallel to the acceleration, or is it because it seems to be just coming out in a trail behind it, like a spiral trail as they move around it, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like it's just coming up, like if the acceleration is toward the other black hole or the center of mass. It seems like it's coming off in that direction as a trail behind it, or is it kind of like a normal wave where we're going all propagate in all directions, kind of like a ripple on a pond, or would it be just a
yeah.
pulse in the opposite direction?
It seems like it's. I would say it seems like it's propagating out much like a ripple in a pond in this
okay.
case. But, yeah.
Because it just looks like in this animation, in most animations you
yeah.
see it, it looks like it's just a trail. Of where its position was, you know? Like, I don't know, it's just...
I don't know exactly. I don't do these simulations, but...
Yeah, that's true.
That's just what comes out of the simulation is
okay.
you get this complicated...
Yeah, and they're saying it's like, so it's a four-dimensional and a two-dimensional
yeah.
image, yeah, so...
It's like a lot, yeah.
When you're just walking across the front, you're causing, I guess, a very weak gravitational wave.
Yeah.
What determines the frequency of the wave, and what are some typical values?
So the frequency of the wave here is determined by how fast these objects are moving. I think the ripple in the pond is kind of like that. So, yeah, so, I mean, in the case of what we're going to see at LIGO, I mean, I think the frequency was on the order of, tens or... of hertz or hundreds of hertz or something like that. But it depends very much on the objects that are merging. If you have these black holes merging, these small black holes, like these stellar mass ones, you get these high frequencies like this. If later, we're thinking about building a space-based detector, which would detect supermassive black holes merging, those would be much lower frequencies. So it depends on the oscillation. It's directly related to the frequency that they're merging at.
More massive black holes merging would give a lower frequency?
Yeah, it would give a lower frequency. Yeah.
Momentum is conserved.
The momentum?
Yeah,
is
the rotating.
Yeah.
Probably after you have a spinning
yeah.
black hole.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You have a spinning black hole, but that black hole, that spinning black hole, actually can't carry all of the angular momentum of the input black holes. And to conserve it, the rest has to go off in gravitational waves.
As far as
I guess they would have. They would be polarized. I mean, yeah, it would carry off. That. Okay. Well.
Thank you for your patience.
Oh no. I appreciate the questions and everything. So let me just get this to play again. So that is a more dynamical solution, and one that you know you really need big computer simulations on supercomputers to get. Okay, now I'm going to talk a little bit about how to detect gravitational waves. So, as I explained before, when a gravitational wave passes, it distorts the space-time and changes the amount of space between objects. So to detect this, we use an interferometer. And so we have, say, two, I'll explain this a bit more later, we have two arms in this interferometer, and we have some suspended masses at the end of them. And as the wave moves, you know, orthogonal to the page, you know, this arm length will change a little bit, this arm length will change a little bit, and we measure that. And in a bit more detail, what we do is we send a laser in to this setup, and then the light is going to bounce back and forth between the suspended masses and this point here. And then finally, some of the light comes out. But this light that comes out going this direction is a combination of these two. And the laser puts in light at a very specific frequency. So you have these waves. And if depending on how they align at the end, you'll either get constructive or destructive interference. And seeing that constructive or destructive interference is what tells you that that your signal passed. Okay, so they build these two interferometers in this laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory in Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana, and they have these 4 kilometer long arms. So these are just from Google Maps. But the goal is eventually build a whole global network of these detectors. So why would you want to have 6 detectors? And the answer is sky localization. So if we have some signal coming from some place in the sky, it propagates at the speed of light. So it will hit some of these detectors before others. And based on that time delay, you can kind of triangulate where in the sky that came from. And then you could go and point your other telescopes at that location and see what see if there's any sort of electromagnetic counterparts, light signals. Yeah?
Is there a reason that we don't have any in the southern hemisphere?
I don't know why there's none. I mean, it's probably more political reasons, or more people that, well, I mean, more people live in the northern hemisphere, and, you know, they built 2 in the U.S. because that's where, you know, the major science funding comes from. But they've tried to spread them out. Like, the new one is LIGO India. That's the, what, in fact, they had, at one of these locations, they had 2 LIGO detectors, and they're moving one of them over to India to get a better location. But I don't know why there's none in the southern hemisphere other than like political reasons and the fact that people don't live there as much. But any other questions? Okay. Yeah. So, but it, you know, in a few more years, they should have all of these running, and that will give us a lot more information about what's coming in. The other reason, of course, they want more than one detector is they want to be really sure that they see a signal, and so you want to see it more than once. Okay, so this is what was detected. This is from the recent paper in February. This is what was detected in on September 14th, 2015, at the Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana detectors. So what we're plotting is the strain, which is effectively the relative size of the two arms as a function of time in the two detectors. So this top thing, this is the original signal, and you can clearly see that there is some sort of signal here that just appeared. And then the very similar signal at Livingston, Louisiana. And they've offset these. It's just shifted here. And that's just so you can see them at the same time. But one of them, I don't remember which one, but one of them saw the signal first, and then it was seen at the next site. So this is a very clear signal. This next figure, they've taken out a bunch of the noise, and we see, you know, we see like the process that was in, remember the video, we had this waveform at the bottom. So this is a clear marker of a gravitational wave. So notice that the frequency increases as they get closer together, and as the process proceeds. And you can see this also in this this time frequency representation, where the frequency is on the horizontal axis. I'm sorry, the vertical axis, and as a function of time. And you see this flip upwards in the frequency, and that's this very characteristic indication that you have a gravitational wave passing. Okay, so now that we see this signal, people do is that they now work backwards and they identify what was it that produced the waves. So they can compare to these numerical simulations that I showed you already. And we see, and from that they can deduce what happened. So we see all of the different phases. So like at this point we see this in spiral phase where the black holes are getting closer and closer together. And then the merger happens at this peak. And then finally, we get this ring down. Now, this is showing a quasi-normal mode. Remember, I showed you that plot of quasi-normal modes. All you really see here is the lowest quasi-normal mode, because all of the higher ones, or the lower ones in that figure, those decay more rapidly, and they don't they don't stick around. So doing this, working backwards, what they find is that this was a merger of two black holes. They were 36 and 29 solar masses. And then the final black hole had 62 solar masses. So that means that you had three solar masses of energy released in gravitational waves. So that's a lot of energy. And then it propagated for 1.3 billion years before reaching Earth, and then we measured it. So as somebody asked about what are the frequencies involved, you can look at the horizontal axis here, and you see that, you know, this was about, I mean, this whole thing is about a fifth of a second that they saw. So that gives you some idea of the time. Yeah, so this is I think the clearest demonstration of what was seen.
Previous slide showed the frequencies actually looked like middle C.
Yeah, oh yeah, there is, yeah, sorry, you do see the frequencies here in hertz. It's hundreds of hertz, you see, at the end. So LIGO has a certain frequency band that it can see, and this is definitely towards the end of the band in terms of frequencies. So we couldn't see any of the signal before this, even though gravitational waves were being emitted, because it was too low a frequency. And that's related to the size of these black holes being 36 and 29 solar masses, was a little bit bigger maybe than people were expecting. But it's still on the order of, like, you know, stellar mass black holes. Okay, so to summarize this stuff so far, well, we have Einstein's equation describing general relativity, and then the solutions correspond to a space-time geometry. And the Einstein equation is much more complicated than the Poisson equation for Newtonian gravity, but the solutions are much more interesting. You can describe black holes, gravitational waves, merging black holes. I didn't talk about it, but it also describes an expanding universe and the Big Bang and everything. And then we finally confirmed through this detection of gravitational waves that some predictions of general relativity in the strong field regime. So we had some evidence before. We saw that we were looking at, we had binary pulsar, which you know, it was just this pair of pulsars, and you could tell that they were in spiraling towards each other, and that was consistent with gravitational waves being emitted, but that's a more of an indirect detection, and now we've actually seen them. So now I'm just going to talk a little bit about some, like, modern research and stuff that I'm working on to give a flavor. So remember, in LIGO, like I said, after the merger, you get this ring down of your gravitational wave perturbation. But the question is, like, does it ever the case that this perturbation would grow and cause what's called an instability? And that's what I do a lot of studies of black hole instabilities. So to understand, say, this one particular instability called the superradiant instability, I need to explain how you can extract mass from a black hole. So usually you think, well, once something falls into a black hole, you can't get anything out. But you can actually extract mass from the black hole. So this relies on the fact that in addition to having a mass, black holes can carry angular momentum or electric charge. So this is the expression for the area of a charged rotating black hole. So it depends on the mass, the angular momentum, and the charge. And the only rule you have in classical processes is that the area of the black hole can't decrease. You don't have a rule that says the mass of the black hole can't decrease. So a physical process is not forbidden from extracting mass from a black hole as long as you also extract sufficient charge and angular momentum. Because if you look at these expressions, the angular momentum and the charge come in with minus signs. So you can reduce M as long as you reduce A and E even more, so the area increases, this combination. So if you throw matter into the black hole and it's got a really large charge to mass ratio or a large angular momentum to mass ratio, then the area theorem says that it can't be absorbed by the black hole, because that's the converse of what I just said. That would decrease the area if there's too much charge and mass falling in. So either that stuff can't fall into the black hole, or it gets amplified when it comes out. So if you send in a gravitational wave with a bunch of angular momentum, after it hits the black hole, it can come out amplified. And this is called super radiance. So now, if we surround that whole black hole by a sort of reflecting boundary, so there's various theoretical reasons why you would want to consider this, but one example might be if you add, if you consider like a massive field would have an effective reflecting boundary and this confining property, then you send a wave into the black hole, then it gets amplified, and it comes back and it reflects off that boundary, and then it goes back to the black hole, it gets amplified again. And it gets amplified by the same factor each time. And that means that the whole thing will lead to an exponential growth. So this is known as the black hole bomb, or the super radiant instability. So there's a question of what is the final state? So are you just going to blow up? Or, I mean, obviously there's going to be some sort of higher order effects to limit this. So we did these simulations in the charged case. So the charged case means I can do this in spherical symmetry. So again, I only have to consider the radial direction and the time-like direction. And I'm considering, what I'm plotting, going to plot here is the charged scalar field outside the black hole, but you can just think of it as some sort of charged matter outside that black hole. And so here, this end is the reflecting mirror. This over here is the black hole horizon. And so I can run it. So I start off with a very small perturbation, and we see that it is going to start growing. And this means that the mass and charge is being extracted from the black hole. Now you can look very closely here. I'm cutting it off. I'm cutting off the simulation at the horizon, or just inside the horizon. And that this point here is kind of moving outwards, which corresponds to the black hole is growing in this process. So it's a bit strange because the stuff outside, it's pulling stuff out of the black hole and the black hole is getting bigger at the same time. And you can see it is growing in amplitude. And this boundary is moving outwards. Yeah, and then it kind of settles down like this. So what happened is the area of that black hole increased, but that meant it was losing charge. And eventually, you can only extract so much charge from a black hole that you have to settle down. This is in a spacetime called asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, but you know, the hope would be that you can find some sort of astrophysical application at some point, or not. We'll see what happens. But this is the kind of thing people are looking at. I can look at another example, which is black hole turbulence. So if you have a very special type of black hole, then the gravitational waves in the vicinity of this black hole actually have this fluid-like behavior. There's this weird relationship between fluid dynamics and black hole perturbations. And so I just think of this as what I'm plotting here is some sort of way of characterizing the gravitational waves outside the black hole. And I'm going to start it in some configuration. And eventually, it forms into these vortices. And you get this complicated fluid-like behavior. You get these formation of these vortices, and they're colliding with each other and forming into larger vortices. So if you find, in fact, you have, if vortices are rotating in the same direction, they merge. If they're rotating the opposite direction, they bounce off of each other. But this is this is what happens in this weird setup. And there's hints that, in fact, you might get behavior like this around very highly spinning black holes in the universe. So anyway, these are just some sort of like interesting behaviors that we're finding kind of at the edge of what you can see in the Einstein equation.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is that like energy itself, like energy storms of space-time, or is that the actual curvature?
That's the curvature of the space-time, yeah. So the waves are just not, it's kind of like, the thing is, if usually you get these black holes that again, they're described by these quasi-normal modes that decay really fast. But if you can find a setup where those quasi-normal modes don't decay very fast, then there's enough time for more interesting things to start happening with them before they decay. And this is what we're seeing here, this complicated behavior.
Oops.
Okay. So finally, to conclude, well, general relativity predicts black holes, gravitational waves, and allows for these complicated dynamics. And we finally begun to probe the strong field regime of general relativity. And we'll soon observe mergers of neutron stars as well as black holes, very likely. And when all these other detectors come online, we're going to get more and more data to confirm general relativity predictions. And really, we're starting this era of gravitational wave astronomy, which is, you know, analogous, in fact, as I've tried to make the case, it's analogous to the, you know, seeing light for the first time. We're seeing gravitational waves. And then, you know, we're, like I was showing right at the end, I mean, we're continuing to discover interesting properties of the Einstein equation, and hopefully in the future we'll find a way to probe these experimentally as well. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that very interesting talk. We've got still a few more time for questions. Any more questions? Yes.
Yep.
Go
ahead. Yep. Sure. I have a question. Is there like a fundamental constant, like a damping constant of space? So we have these gravitational waves propagating. Once they're out there, or is there a damping constant?
Yeah, there's, I mean, there's no like intrinsic sort of damping of the gravitational wave. It has to do with what space-time they're propagating it. So like the black hole has its own damping constants, like I was illustrating. It will depend on the particular black hole you're looking at, and that's how we characterize them, in fact, by, you know, we see these oscillation frequencies. So that's one type of the damping. The other type of damping is propagation up to infinity, and then the damping associated with that is you're going to get like a 1 over r squared fallout, just like you would have for any sort of wave just expanding outwards.
Right. The energy of space itself is not.
No, it just has to. No, you don't have anything other than that. Yeah.
Just the same question, maybe. Just if the black hole have a viscosities.
Yeah.
No. So, but it's a space.
Yeah.
Design. So maybe the rest of space-time have a viscosities too.
Well, no. I mean, really, it's
not. You have viscosities
yeah.
there, but not there.
Well, the viscosity has to do. Let me go back a few slides. The viscosity. Oops. Oh, this is a mess. Let me play on this. Yeah, so the viscosity here has to do entirely with stuff falling into here. That's how you get this viscosity associated to the black hole. It always has to do with, you know, flying off to infinity or falling into a black hole. There's no other source of viscosity. Yeah, well, you can think of it as viscosity if you want, but it's more that it's falling away, you know, it's like, that's it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you had your hand up first.
Yeah, something came up a couple of years ago in one of my classes. Somebody asked, what if the sun disappeared, how long would it take before we felt it here?
Yeah.
So I guessed speed of light.
Yeah, that's right.
Then I got a conversation continued. If I understand it correctly, if you go back to Maxwell and his prediction of the speed of light,
yeah,
his calculation.
Yeah.
Was based on measurements of electric constant and magnetic constant for space,
yeah,
into space,
yeah,
and then from his equations he calculated a theoretical speed of light, and then now,
yeah,
there's no equivalent measurements for gravity, or there's g, but where is the speed of light? Is it assigned? Did Einstein just assign it to the gravity waves, or did it come from something else?
I think it comes from Lorentz invariance. I mean, it just comes from special relativity. Any theory that's consistent with special relativity is going to have a maximum propagation speed.
The picture's a maximum, but that doesn't mean something can't be below the maximum.
No, I mean, it doesn't. And I mean, in fact, I mean, in if you have an odd number of space-time dimensions, you don't have propagation just along the light cone. you can have propagation to the interior of the light cone as well. So that's the Huygens principle, is violated in different numbers of dimensions. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what anything to say other than the fact that this is just what comes out in the solutions, is you find your gravitational waves propagate the speed of light once you have this theory written down.
So far, we have no way to check that the speed of gravity is speed of light?
I think there's some, yeah, that's a good question. There might be some stuff in the LIGO paper about with this gravitational wave detection. I don't know any other test. I don't know off the top of my head, but people do try to test that kind of thing.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah?
Sorry. Yeah. Is it strictly necessary to have infinite curvature? Or can you, will the math not work if it's like slightly less than infinite curvature?
Well, you mean in the black hole,
yeah,
the singularity? Well, it's really the math is telling you have the infinite curvature. That's the solution.
That's the solution. But if it doesn't work any, you can't. I mean, because the question is it truly, you know, physicist versus a mathematician? Is it truly infinite curvature?
Well, no, we
can
think,
you make it work without infinite curvature?
Yeah, so people try to make it work without infinite curvature. And to do that, you need to go beyond general relativity. And so you think that that when you have such big curvature, really quantum gravity effects become important. And there should be some sort of quantum effect should limit this and bring everything away from infinity like that. But at the level of the Einstein equation, that's just what you get. But it's a classical theory. Yeah?
I guess under what circumstances is it valid to assume that the curvature is zero? Assume the curvature is zero, curvature of the space-time is zero?
Yeah, so in some cases, you would have very little curvature. Far away from the black hole or far away from the Earth, I mean, you have small, low curvature, and that's a good approximation for most physics we do. I mean, if we want to calculate some sort of electromagnetic process in this room, we can basically ignore the curvature.
So what's the curvature of the space-time of the universe?
Well, at large scales, the universe is described by cosmology. So like most of the curvature is associated with this expanding universe. And it's directly related to the average amount of matter in the universe through the Einstein equation. I don't know what the average density of matter is in the universe, but that's something that one could look up, and that would be the curvature on average in the universe.
In your research,
yeah,
you thought about a reflecting surface around the black hole.
Yeah.
This is not reflecting light. This is reflecting gravitational
waves. Yeah.
So what reflects gravitational waves?
Well, yeah. So the context here is something called anti-de Sitter spacetime, which is, it's a very kind of theoretical construct. And it has a different structure at infinity. So usually, I mean, this is what's called an asymptotically flat spacetime, which means far away from the black hole, it's like flat. And if you send a wave off there, it will just go forever. Asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetimes happen to have this property that you have this boundary of your space-time, and it gets reflected back. So that's the context I studied it in. More in an astrophysical sense, if you had a massive field outside a black hole, then that mass term, it behaves like some sort of effective potential barrier. It's not exactly a mirror. It's a bit leaky, I guess, but it could have a similar kind of effect.
So that would be like another massive black hole?
No, not a black hole. Just if you had a field that, so ooh, if you have, yeah, I think your matter itself has, it's a particular type of matter that is of interest theoretically, and people here, Mina Arvanitaki has tried to use the super radiance instability to try to constrain possible fields like that, because if you had a massive field, then it would cause the black hole to lose angular momentum. And then if you observed a black hole with more angular momentum than that, then that would mean that that field doesn't that field is there and if you observe a black hole with lots of angular momentum, then that would mean that that field wasn't there to extract it. So you put bounds on masses of fields like that. So that's an example of how you could get kind of an effective barrier similar to that. Yeah.
Do you happen to know the current angular resolution of the LIGO system and what it should be when it goes global?
Yeah.
In terms of.
I don't know what it's
an astronomical question.
I don't know exactly. Yeah, I don't know exactly what the numbers are.
Yeah.
Right now, it's not very good. I mean, like, but they have some. I mean, it's like ballpark. I don't know what kind of
it's an astronomical question.
Yeah, I don't know if they're talking about like. Yeah, right now it's maybe like. Not very good. It's like a quarter of the sky or something. I mean, they're like big arcs all over the sky, kind of.
And,
but
and a question related: you happen to know the statistics of mergers? How often are they expecting to be like? Are these things how often, five a day or what's
yeah.
the stats on that?
Well, right now, they've observed two mergers, and so they know that you have at least that many. And but there's a. I mean, I think the estimates. It depends how far your observatory can see, and you know as it depends how sensitive it is. But I think what I've heard is like for binary black holes, they were expecting between something like now 200 and 400 mergers a year in the region that they could see. So, but that's a big. I mean, obviously, as you know, as the range improves, you'll see more and more of them. I don't know. Maybe it'll get up to like one per month or one per week or something like that as we improve. But eventually there's kind of a limit to what you can see once your detector is able to see all the way back to like you know the early times in the universe when we didn't have very many black holes. But at this point we're still trying to make it bigger and see more. But yep. The back.
You said there are like the black hole is the mass is increasing.
Yeah.
At one time it is actually stabilized itself, right?
Yeah.
Is it there any possibility that it increases so much that it really swallows the whole, you know, Earth and all these galaxies?
Yeah, that doesn't happen, fortunately. But they will continue to grow, but I think the rate at which it's going to start is going to be absorbing everything is not that quick. And I mean, remember, like you know, we don't fall into the sun, right? We orbit around it. It's not just you have to have you know the right orbital parameters in order to actually fall into the black hole, and you also have objects that are unbound from the black hole orbit, right? So I don't think that's any sort of danger to worry about. You had your hand up first.
So. Oh, okay. So this is kind of a sci-fi question.
Okay.
But like you had another image, like the following image on this, like right at the end of the slide,
mm-hmm.
where it basically looked like a wormhole.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So then... But then we also looked at like the cones of light and the world lines on the space-time diagram
yeah.
is 45 degrees.
Yeah.
So does this kind of imply that a wormhole is created, but we can't go through it?
Exactly.
Or?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So this is a non-traversable wormhole. You'd have to go to get from this part of the universe
uh-huh.
over to here, you have to go faster than the speed of light.
Right.
So this is a non-traversable wormhole. You can also make traversable wormholes, but the problem is... I mean, when we go to the Einstein equation, you have that right-hand side. And to make a traversable wormhole, you have to have very unphysical matter on the right-hand side. You have to have, for example, negative energy density, which doesn't make any sense. But you can make one, and there's people trying to, but it's not going to work out very well.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Yeah.
This is, I don't know if it's even a logical question, but are there any ideas from quantum mechanics that are in the direction that this research or these thoughts are going? Is there any connection at all?
Sorry, what thoughts? Like this, the wormhole?
Research or this black holes or super gravity?
Or super radiance, or you, yeah. So there, that there's some kind of quantum motivation for like the stuff I do, which is that there's this. Okay, this is called the anti de Sitter space conformal field theory correspondence, which it's just kind of it's
I'm
this
sorry.
Like it, no it's fine. I mean there's this like it's been a big thing in physics over the past few years. If we're trying to there's this conjecture, there's this relationship between lower dimensional theories, quantum theories, living on this boundary that I mentioned, and gravity inside. So that's what motivated that fluid correspondence and everything. You had your hand up for a long time.
What sensitivity will we need to be able to detect something not catastrophic? Like we're waiting for black holes to crash.
Yeah.
When will we be able to see a black hole?
That would be. I mean, we see them merge. I mean, we see them before they collide. But let me try to think. I don't know. Nestor, do you have any ideas?
What's the question, sorry?
When will we see non-merger events?
Maybe
event horizon telescope.
Oh, well,
we can do that right now.
Event, but that's not going to see.
No,
that's not gravitational waves.
Spinning neutron stars.
I don't know. That's not something people talk about so much.
Which would be violent events going on, right? And a single black hole. I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. But I mean, I remember hearing something about this, but I can't remember. But that's not what people are looking for now. It might be. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Far from that.
Yeah, we're far away. Or actually, you had your hand up first.
All right, very simple question. Is there anything happening around us here? I never had the chance to go out there.
Anything?
Is there anything happening around us here that's analogous or similar to?
Yeah, so
it's black holes.
The reason we look at black holes is because they have such strong curvature. And your light cones tip over here and everything. Around the Earth, the size of the potential is of order 10 to the minus 9 or something like that. Like that's the relative size of the metric perturbation compared to the actual flat metric. And here it's of order 1. So the point is that the gravitational fields are, you know, a factor of a billion weaker around here than around the black hole. And that's just why there's nothing. That's why Newtonian gravity is a very good approximation around here, and we don't need any of these effects. We do see little effects. I mean, like, so in fact, one of the first tests of Einstein's gravity was the perihelion precession of Mercury. So planets go on ellipses, and it kind of shifts around a little bit. Yeah. So you see a very minute change, and that was like a first test, you know, it was completely consistent with that, and that was previously unexplained. But they're very small effects around here. But there are little effects. Yeah. Yeah.
This is more an advice question for students. If the student's interested in general relativity and, say, numerical general relativity,
yeah.
Do you do your own coding? What's the, when in those cases, do you have someone help you? That should they be also studying a certain particular language in order to do the computing end of it, or how does that work?
Yeah, so I mean, I use very, you saw my simulation was like 1 + 1 dimensional,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, there's a 2 + 1 dimensional simulation, and that's just done in Fortran, and
okay.
It's really not sophisticated in that sense. But I mean, like these simulations, like the one I showed you from LIGO, this is a very sophisticated one, you know, showing merging black holes, and I would not recommend building that from scratch.
Yeah.
But I think probably some of these people make their code available on the internet. But it also, I mean, keep in mind, I mean, those simulations require supercomputers as well. And mine, I just, you know, I run that on my laptop and, you know, I...
But generally, yeah. What I'm trying to get is this a collaborative thing where you get some theoretical physicists to say,
yeah.
here are some equations, make this work,
yeah.
And there's an IT guy who
writes the code, yeah.
Writing your own code.
So we have some people who are more inclined towards numerics than others, and,
yeah.
You know, but like a project like what I'm talking about would be like me and one or two other people, and some of us are better at computer coding than others, but, you know, that's just basically built from scratch with, you know, a few people who are knowledgeable about computers, but we don't need, like, really computer scientists to help with that. The big simulations, I would say, like, you need computer scientists working on that to make it work well. Yep. But, yeah?
Sorry, I'm still trying to wrap my head around these upward curving bits of space-time.
Upward curving.
Yeah, this
in this video
oh.
here.
Yeah,
there,
so
there
actually
are,
the caption here.
As I understand it, I'm highly, highly attuned
yeah.
to admitting I'm wrong anyway. The downward curve of space-time is what we experience as gravity.
Yeah, so.
So these bits where it's upward curving, is that in any sense?
I don't see where you see it's upward curving.
Exactly.
Oh,
those points.
Oh, those?
Yeah.
But those are.
The collision as well.
Yeah, but the. Okay, so it says the height of the colored surface illustrates the curvature of space. So it's just saying you're having, you know, you have curvature, you know, twisted in weird directions around the black hole. I mean,
it's not in any sense indicative of any kind of anti-gravity? Or
No.
Right.
One thing that you always see is it turns red near the black hole, and that's because you get a big time dilation effect.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the spatial curvature is just quite complicated, and there's no anti-gravity or anything
involved. Right, so the geometry of the surface that's represented here is
yeah.
not the same as the geometry of surfaces that you've shown us before.
Yeah, so this is like a, sorry if I hit anybody in the eye with that, but this is...
it's okay, I had it coming.
Yeah, so, and remember, this is a particular spatial slice too, right? If you took a different, slightly different spatial slice, you would see different behavior. So it's slice dependent and stuff too.
I think it's just because we're looking at a sort of 2D flat shape, and as they're rotating, two waves from each are constructively being to give a bigger aperture. We're seeing that, imagining it as like almost on a water surface where the wave looks bigger, but
or,
I think it's probably a representation of the strength is bigger rather than the amplitude.
Session on TR, we'll talk about embedding diagrams, and I think that you'll understand this a lot better after that, or at least I hope so.
Are those bumps gather higher here, but relative to the outside, they're still lower. They're still in gravity well.
Yeah, I mean, they still look high relative to the outside, but it's your curvature can be. You can be.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, if you have again thinking about like, well, if you're stirring up some water, you're going to get some waves going up and some waves going down.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening here. Overall it's down. Oh, I see, because you mean because the black hole is overall causes this
yeah.
big
yeah, so there's,
hole.
There's a big negative well.
Yeah, so there is this
these
big negative
curving lobes.
Yeah, I think that just has to do with how they slice the space-time.
I mean,
and
stretching and compression of space-time itself.
Yeah,
the gravitational wave is also going up and down. It's gravity, anti-gravity,
yeah.
stretching
yeah.
and compressing.
Yeah, it's a combination of the waves and you know, fairly complicated dynamics and everything, and sometimes it goes up. Yeah. Yeah.
The visible universe can be modeled as having an event horizon as the most distant galaxies are leaving our light zone.
Yeah.
Could the expansion of the universe and dark energy be related to the black hole instability that you're studying?
No, I don't think. I mean, the dark energy is that's more just like a parameter in the equation. I would say it's not. It's a different type of thing, I would say.
When LIGO detected the first merger, you said it was 1.3 billion years old.
Yeah.
Like, how did they get that number?
That's from a combination of, you know, so that's going to have to do with the various properties of, I don't know how the details, but it comes from the waveform that they see, and like its amplitude and the frequencies and how fast the frequencies are decaying at the end, how the frequencies are changing early on, all those things, all those various parameters go into modeling the source. And then if they can figure out, well, this source had to be a certain number of solar masses merging, then they can look at, see what the overall amplitude is, and that would tell you how far that wave has been propagating. And then we can use what we know about cosmology to say how long ago that had to happen. Yes, so it's the amplitude is going to go as 1 over r squared, just because it's just, you know, flying away like that. And then, yeah, to get the time, you combine that with what you know about how the universe expanded during that time.
The two detectors,
so redshift has to be considered as well, but...
Yeah, the redshift is going to be part of that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, all of that's going to fit in together. Did you...
Yeah, the two detectors, did they measure, like, the same amplitude? Like, there was no difference in, like, one detector got a bigger...
I don't know. I mean, you had to look... I don't remember what the figure had, but the thing is, they're going to measure slightly... I think my keynote crashed, but, I mean, you're going to measure... slightly different amplitudes because the detectors are angled differently relative to each other, and so you're going to measure depending on the polarization of the waves and the direction that the wave is coming from, you'll get a different overall amplitude in your signal.
I just wonder what practical applications are. Big words and formulas have to do with problems we have here. What are the practical applications of all of this? Possible, maybe not now. But
yeah.
It's still very early.
I don't know. I mean, I think you're at the wrong institute, but. No, I don't know. I mean, it's more, you know, we're trying to discover how the universe works and everything. And at this point, there's no practical applications, but. It's the same with quantum theory or something. I mean, if you ask somebody who invented the laser to justify this, they're not going to say, well, it'll be really useful in supermarket checkout lines or something, right? anyway.
That may be a good note to end on. So thank you very much. I think